Welcome to a Prevent Connect podcast, where we explore the prevention of violence against women. This is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. The following presentation takes place at the 2011 Forum for Primary Prevention Advocates called Ending Violence Against Women and Teen Dating Violence. Keynote speakers Christy Chung, a consultant from GroundSpark, and Amy Thompson, executive director of Close to Home, talk about the way in which effective primary prevention is social change and social justice work.
We had an amazing opportunity to spend some time together on the phone, and Amy came out here early, so last week we also got to spend a little time in person to really wrestle with some questions about what would support us as a community to really think more deeply about prevention, about the work that we're doing, and what would we need in order to sort of kick us off and to really think about what would help us practice while we're here and also practice when we leave. Doing this work not just by ourselves or at our organizations, but together and really in community with one another to really think about how are we going to do this work and how are we going to do it together? Because I really do believe we are the ones that we've been waiting for.
And so for the next 40 minutes, Christy and I are basically going to invite you into the conversation that we've been having about how do we really effectively deepen our social change work together, in the hopes that we'll be able to continue that conversation through the next several days.
So here's the big question. What do we need to create self-transforming and community-transforming social change? That's big, right? Oh, just a few things. Well, we're going to tell you a few of them.
Of course, we know that it takes many things to create self and community transforming social change. We've already heard about some this morning, and we're going to hear about more over the next few days. It takes things like community organizing and school climate work and policy change and collaboration and partnerships. But there are a few specific things that we wanted to just offer up for your consideration.
So the first one is beloved community. The second one is spaciousness. And the third one is movement.
So our goals are to spend this time inviting you into this conversation and dialogue. And then, as was discussed, move into a different type of participation. So again, we're all in a shared learning environment where we're all actively leading and participating with each other.
We wanted to really spend some time thinking about what this means to us. And in particular, we wanted to start with beloved community. I wanted to start first with the history. Where does it come from? How many of you have heard of beloved community before? Oh, not so many folks in the room. So this might be new for some folks. Let me just first sort of define what beloved community, when we looked it up in the dictionary, meant. Because, you know, it is complicated. It's a big concept. First, beloved, greatly loved, dear to the heart. And number two, a person who is greatly loved. Community, a group sharing common characteristics or interests or perceiving itself as distinct. Martin Luther King is actually the one who talked about it first. It was a concept that was really important to him in his organizing, in the work that he did in the civil rights movement. It was a really, really important thing in the way that he was trying to build community and invite people into the work and to really make some deep changes. And that it was extremely important to him to really think about how do we do this work? And how do we do this work in a way that is building community? So I want to just share some of the things that were important to him about beloved community. He wanted it to be realistic. He wanted it to be attainable and achievable. And he wanted those things to happen with a critical mass of people. It's pretty amazing what he accomplished. He wanted it to be global. So not just one community, not just one small church, not one small town, but he wanted it to be global. He wanted it to be connected and to be all-inclusive. so that we weren't leaving people out, that we weren't leaving folks behind, that it was all of us together. He wanted it to be peaceful and nonviolent, and he wanted it to have justice. When I was doing the research and I was reading about him, what I think was so amazing was that he wanted justice for all. And that in his concepts, he was working at the intersections. He wasn't looking at it as one issue or justice for one or justice for one community. He was looking at justice for all. In his notes, he says, not just for one oppressed group, but for all people. That injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And I think for me, as someone who lives the intersections and doing intersectional work is so important, it was really, really important to me to hear that Martin Luther King was talking about intersections. And I really hope that today and as we work together into the future that we really start thinking about intersections and how do we do this work in an intersectional way? How do we deal with multiple issues? How do we really understand how we're going to move this change together as we start to do this work as a community? I also want to say that he was an amazing leader, and we have lots of amazing leaders. And today we have another incredible leader that we want to talk about, and that is Grace Lee Boggs. She is another incredible leader who talks about beloved community and who really can help us, I think, today think about what does that mean for us now. And I want to really turn it over to Amy to share some of those thoughts.
I just wanted to share this quote from Martin Luther King Jr. Related to beloved community, which is that that our goal is to create a beloved community, and this will require a qualitative change in our souls as well as a quantitative change in our lives. And so what he's talking about here is this transformative work. And so Grace Lee Boggs is actually a 96-year-old Chinese-American activist. And how many people are familiar with her or her work? So we have a handful of people. Today is actually her 96th birthday. It was so fun to realize that we would be celebrating her in this way today. But she was born in 1915. In Providence, Rhode Island, actually in the upstairs of a Chinese restaurant that her dad owned, and so has participated in the last 96 years in many, many social movements in U.S. history, from tenants' rights work. Some of her early organizing was actually doing work in the African-American community around poor housing conditions. So from tenants' rights to civil rights work, she was involved in the women's movement, and many, many other movements over the last 96 years. She actually got very involved during the civil rights movement in the Black Power movement, and through her organizing in the civil rights movement met her husband. And so she and her husband then moved to Detroit about 50 years ago, and she has been doing place-based organizing in Detroit for the last 50 years. Her husband died about 20 years ago. I actually had the good fortune last month to participate in a roundtable discussion with her, talking about our work to end gender violence, and had that discussion with her in the context of all of the movement work she has done here in the United States these last decades. And it was so incredibly inspiring to be able to engage with her and just listen to her tell her stories. She was so incredibly humble and funny, and so grounded in this belief that she has here, where she says that what we urgently need in this period are the kinds of self-transforming and structure-transforming direct actions moving us toward the radical revolution in values advocated by Martin Luther King in the last 3 years of his life. In Gandhi's words, we must be the change we want to see in the world. And it was so amazing to be in the presence of somebody that is actually living that. And so some of the most inspiring things to me about her work or the conversation that we were able to have was really about her focus on place. so that she has this very deep commitment to living this change, but living it out in the context of community in the most radical way. And so that has meant investing in engaging with young people, doing this intergenerational organizing, transforming vacant lots into community gardens that are leadership development activities, economic development activities. And the other thing that she, when we asked what her greatest accomplishment was, in that conversation she said that it was simply that she was still around and still learning. And so she talked in the conversation about what for her was the most impactful thing was this, the constant process of transformation. And that she didn't necessarily intentionally get involved in all of these movements, but it was really about following her interest, following her curiosity, and this ongoing spirit of learning that both kind of affected her in her own development, her own transformation and evolution is how she described it, and then, of course, affected her engagement with the broader community that she was part of. So I think that I would encourage, I also, you know, just have just sort of gotten to know her and her work in these last months. And so I would encourage all of you to, you know, continue to read. She just has a new book that's come out that's really wonderful. And so I think that there is so much from her example that we can bring forward with us. And so some of the components in her mind of a beloved community are developing communities that are sustainable, are environmentally just, ecologically responsible, and then again, carry forward this this value of justice, and thinking about that in the broadest, most intersectional way. And I think that she also the community center that she is part of, the Center for Beloved Communities, really is promoting how we think about not just new ways of developing programs, but new ways of thinking, living, and being with each other. So thinking beyond sort of our program work to sort of really what it means to be the change and to live the change that we want to see. And then just to close, because there's, I mean, obviously so much to say about Grace, but I want to just share a funny anecdote that at the end of the conversation, one of the people at the roundtable actually asked her, what is the thing that you do to have fun? And so she got very serious after this very serious conversation about social change. And then smiled, she has an amazing smile, and then said, drink beer. So, you know, like, we can still have fun, right, as we are trying to do this really intense social change work. So now we're going to actually transition into Christy and I sharing a little bit after thinking about this and talking about this, what beloved communities have meant for each of us.
And I'd also like to invite each of you, as we're telling our stories, to think about what beloved community means to you. Have you had an experience? Have you had something in your life where you feel like it's come close to that? What were some of the elements of it that really meant to you, made it feel like it was a beloved community to you? So Amy and I wanted to share a little bit about our own experiences. And I would say that I've had many opportunities to be in different communities. And many of those have been really identity-based. So as an Asian American woman, as a queer woman, as a parent, as someone who's mixed race, there have been many opportunities for me in terms of my identities to really participate and join and actually create some of my own communities. But I have to say that it was as a parent that I started to really recognize what it meant to be part of a community that was really trying to support maybe a broader group of us, and especially supporting young people. So I want to talk a little bit about how I ended up getting to school communities and why I do school climate change. And it started with my daughter being born and her starting school and me realizing that as a queer family, as an Asian family, I had to make decisions about what school she was going to go to. I had to figure out what school climate was she going to thrive in? Where was she going to be supported? How was our family going to be supported? And luckily enough, we did find a really amazing school, not perfect, because I don't think any school is. And now at this point in my life, I actually don't look for perfect communities. I look for folks who I want to be with, who I want to work with, who I think are going to, where there's going to be allies for me and for my family and for my daughter. And we found a really incredible school. And there were lots of really great things about it, but the piece I want to tell you is just about her kindergarten experience. And it does start that young for young people, really needing a school climate that's going to support them. She had a teacher who was really committed to creating a really strong classroom climate that supported all of the young people in our classroom. We were at a school where they spoke both English and Japanese, so she had a Japanese teacher as well. And when they worked on family structure issues, when they talked about different kinds of families, they included ours. And they talked about two moms, and they talked about two dads. And they worked really hard to find the language in Japanese to also share those stories. And at the end of the class, at the end of that year, the teacher found the money to be able to buy a book that was Todd Parr's book, The Family Book, and it includes lots of different kinds of families in it, including two moms and two dads. And that was, for my daughter, huge, to have an entire year of being supported. Now, the really amazing thing was that her best friend took that book and told her mom, "Oh my God, check this out. I am taking this to Utah to share with my cousins because they don't know anything about two moms and two dad families." So, if you think that you and your family don't have an impact on the people around you, think again. It is really, really important to us, to me, to work at the intersection, to really think about what it meant to have her Asian identity be supported at school, to have her family structure be supported at school, in order for her to grow up into a now 13-year-old who can now say very proudly that I am Asian and I'm proud and I have two moms, and she can talk to people at her school about what that means, whether they understand it, whether they have the connection, whether they have the context in which that happens in, and they have questions, and she feels good about it, and she has learned how to find allies in her school. And I think one of the reasons I work in schools is because I know that as adults, we are responsible for that climate. We need to help make sure that those climates are safe and supportive and supporting them to learn. And I also know that our young people in our life, they need to have that kind of support in order to grow and be leaders and to take this to the next step. We're not going to all be around to keep doing this work.
I think one of the things that's so powerful about your story is the way that how beloved community, the meaning for that for you is really related to your experience in the world, in your history, in your stories. And I think that that is similar for me and how I think about or try to be in or create beloved community in my own life. Of course, some of our first experiences of community are in our families. And I come from a family with a multi-generation history of domestic and sexual violence. And so a lot of my memories, my early memories of family celebrations and holidays, you know, are sitting around. There were seven kids in my dad's family, and so you know, I have many aunts and uncles and many, many more cousins. So my early memories are of having these huge Christmas dinners at the local VFW. There were too many of us to sit in anyone's house, so we would rent the local VFW and have a potluck. But remember sitting there and being able to look around the room and think to myself or see the connections of violence between the different people in my family, whether it was domestic violence or child abuse or child sexual abuse, and see all of that and know that child protection had been involved in my family's life and that the police had been involved in my family's life. But this is a story that nobody was talking about. And so maybe some of you have had this experience or have heard other people in your lives talk about this, but there was so much energy bound up in the keeping of those secrets and the inability to tell those stories and to be in sort of safe celebratory space with each other. And so I think that a lot of my own search for a beloved community has been searching for spaces and places where I could tell the truth about my life and my stories and other people, and we could all be together with our stories and telling the truth around that, particularly around violence. I actually moved to Boston 17 years ago because there was a group of African-American Christian intellectuals that decided to make a radical commitment to community, really in the tradition of Martin Luther King, and saw that one of the outcomes of the some of the successes we've had around desegregation and busing in Boston was actually that many middle-class black families had left urban centers in Boston. And so they were really interested in moving back into the city and making a radical commitment to community and to neighborhoods. And so it was with those activists that I began my early work in Boston. And it was incredible work. We were growing community gardens and doing amazing voter registration and organizing work to try to address a lot of the violence issues, community violence issues that were happening. And early in that work, one of the young people that I was working with was this amazing young man, amazing young leader, actually was arrested. His mom called me and said, Hank's been arrested. And I couldn't imagine why. And it turned out that he and some friends had sexually assaulted a young woman. And so I think that that was another, you know, important lesson in my own journey in recognizing how that even in that space, even in that beloved community that we were working to create, we were still not addressing issues of domestic and sexual violence. And that's really what led me on my own journey to start close to home and to begin to enter, see the Dorchester community where I have been living all this time with these conversations of how do we start to talk about and bring to the surface the issues of gender violence, teen dating violence, and these violences that I think take away so much of the energy and so much of the potential that we all have to do creative and wonderful things. And so we're going to be talking more and more about that. How do we surface those conversations in community and build beloved community in the context of gender violence and teen dating violence? So Christy and I put together a summary after we talked through our stories and thinking about beloved community, about some of the elements that we think are central to this. And I'll just let you look at these here, but the highlights are honoring each other's stories, having a sense of belonging and connection, being able to take risks with each other, to challenge each other and do things that are scary so we can push ourselves and grow and continue that transformative process. We talked a lot about the importance of being held and challenged and actually drew a lot of lessons from this project and how important the spaces in this project that we'll all talk more about in the coming days meant for us. And then finally, we talked about how in beloved community, having a common purpose and vision can be so helpful. So we actually wanted to give you all a moment just to think quietly about this, and maybe take a couple of notes that you can carry forward with you over the next several days, to think about what does beloved community mean to you? When have you experienced this sense of community that we've that Martin Luther King and Grace Lee Boggs and we provided some illustrations of? And then how does your work and your activism in your mind foster beloved community?
So I'm going to move us on to another concept which seemed really, really important to us in our conversations. It felt like it was one of the things that would really help us deepen our work and really help us commit to some deeper social change. And that is spaciousness. And what is spaciousness? I had to look it up because I know what it feels like inside of me, but I wasn't sure how to articulate it. So containing much space, occupying much space, vast. So this room is pretty spacious. Of great extent or area. So thinking about oceans or mountains and forests, broad in scope, range, and this is interesting, inclusiveness, right? Inclusiveness. For example, a spacious approach to a problem. So I want to invite us to really think about spaciousness because I think we often don't have that in our lives. So here's some elements that I think spaciousness includes. Time, that we often don't have enough of, right? Quiet, so an opportunity to just get quiet and take a deep breath and be able to reflect or notice things without judgment. Space. So we need space to be able to spread out, to be able to just breathe and move, and to be able to think. And the last one is open. And I think of open as being able to open our hearts and our minds to new things, to new thoughts, to new ways of approaching our work and each other and our communities. And I want to just say to just try and really hold those and think about why they're important. Important for our growth, important for us to thrive, important for us to learn, to create, and to just have time to be together and get to know one another. I think that spaciousness offers us lots of important opportunities that we might completely miss if we don't allow for it. So there are lots of them, and I just want to highlight about four that I think might help us through the next 3 days and help us as we start to really envision what deep change looks like. So learning is huge. It's one of the things I think that Grace Lee Boggs said that an activist needs most of, is to be able to keep learning. And I think about learning as learning from each other. I think someone this morning said take responsibility for our own learning, and I think that's key. And really thinking about how we learn about the things that we don't necessarily know about. So that we're doing that to really help deepen our work. So one of the things I would say that I really know that I need to do some work around and that I have some learning to do is around being an ally to youth. I know that as an adult, I hold a certain amount of power in this world. I get to make a lot of decisions. I have access to things that they don't have. And I need to take a look at that and be willing to learn about what that is. But it's not their responsibility to teach me about that. It is my responsibility to learn, and it is my responsibility to just listen and know that that is where I stand in this world and that I do have a responsibility to be an ally and learn about it. So really offering that as an opportunity for this time together to really spend that time learning the things that you need to know more about and being willing to take that chance to ask someone else to learn with us. So the next one is self-reflection, self-care, and self-transformation. And so I want to just really offer that as an opportunity for us to stop and think about where are we at in this world. How are we going to do this work? And how do we take care of ourselves in this work? And what does it mean to do that? I think we talk about it a lot. We say, yes, I should do some self-care. Yes, that's a great idea. I should do that. And then we don't make time for it. And it's a problem. We need to make space for other people. We need to make sure that as we're doing this work, we're opening up the space for others. So that we are including other people, that we aren't being unintentionally not leaving people out. And I think sometimes we intentionally do that, and sometimes we unintentionally do that. Sometimes we're like, okay, I got a deadline. I don't have time to check in with that community. We're moving on. And then sometimes it is just we didn't make space to think about the other folks that are in our community that we need to hear from. And last is building relationships. I think we often say we want to build those relationships. We want to be, we want to connect with folks. We want to learn from them, but we don't necessarily make time to stop and do that. And I think this is a great opportunity. We're at this amazing forum. We're all here. This is a really good time for us to be building relationships with each other and thinking about where we're headed. If we don't do that work, well, actually, I get about a million of you are saying, oh my God, I don't have time for that. Christy, I don't have time for spaciousness. And so I think that, you know, we have to think about that. That's the reality. Sometimes we let things get in our way, like money, expectations, deliverables. Where's that logic model that you need to get to me? And sometimes it's our own selves, you know, and each other that get in the way of allowing for spaciousness. Okay, so did you get that outline done yet? And sometimes it's about me just not prioritizing self-care or building relationships or learning. So I really want to just offer that up as some things for us to think about. Think about making some spaciousness as we're here together and really inviting you in your life to create some spaciousness. So think about what are some of the ways in which you might create some spaciousness here for yourself, but also how will you take that when you leave, because you're going to need it. If we don't do that, we burn out. We stop working, and we need all of us to be doing this work together. So I'm going to just touch on a few things that I think help me do some self-care and some spaciousness. So going for a walk during the day, like leaving the office, hello, and going for a walk with someone else if you need to. Slowing down the process, and I don't mean just your own process, but like our projects. We are the ones who are setting deadlines, right? And so sometimes we have to do less, or sometimes we have to make more time to do them. Allowing for changes and new opportunities and new directions to occur in our projects. So, you know, a lot of times we're working on stuff and we don't stop and say, hey, actually, this is a really great piece that's happening here and we need to make time for it. So maybe we're working together with youth and there is a great conversation happening. And instead of saying, you know, oh, we need to get that slideshow done, so can you move forward on that? We just need to make space for that conversation to happen. And then making sure that we're making space for everyone to participate. And I think I already kind of covered that. So I hope that we can start to make more space in our lives and more space in our work for each other, for learning, for really building our relationships with each other, and for making sure that we're being really inclusive in the work that we're doing, and that we're able to work at the intersections.
I think actually the spaciousness will help us stay in the work longer, but I also think it makes us more effective and can make our work even more powerful. And we have a poem that we would like to share with you that illustrates that, that Ramesh is going to read for all of us. It's called Fire.
And again, with the abdication of responsibility theme that I'm going for, I'm actually going to do this with my friend Allison. What makes a fire burn is the space between the logs, a breathing space. Too much of a good thing, too many logs packed in too tight can douse the flames almost as surely as a pail of water.
So building fires requires attention to the spaces in between as much as to the wood.
When we are able to build open spaces in the same way we have learned to pile on logs, then we come to see how it is the fuel and the absence of fuel together that makes fire possible.
We only need to lay a log lightly from time to time. A fire grows, simple because the space is there, with the openings in which the flame that knows just how it wants to burn can find its way.
Thank you.
And so what I love about the poem is I love the, you know, we talked about space, but now we're going to talk about the wood, right, the fuel. And how do we really, what is the fuel that's going to allow us to move our work forward in powerful ways? And so the definitions that we pull of a movement, if you look it up in the dictionary, has, you know, actually, I don't know, has like 16 or 17 or 18 different definitions to it. So the ones that we found interesting, the one to share with you this morning, were the act, process, or result of moving, right? So moving our bodies, moving things, a series of actions or activities intended or tending towards a particular end. So maybe some of our work could be related to that, the movements that we're part of. And then I also like this last one, a principal division or section of a sonata, symphony, or the like. Motion, rhythm, time, tempo. So thinking about how we're in rhythm together, making music together, and dancing together through this the social change work that we are engaged in. So I wanted to start by talking about social movements, right? We've talked about many of those today, the civil rights movement, women's movement, tenants' rights work. And so the definition, this is from the Movement Strategy Center, of a social movement is when a large group of people and organizations come together to challenge the power structure, address a fundamental injustice, restore critical social values, implement a new vision, and persuade and inspire the public vision. So in addition to the past examples that I've given, we have some tremendous, you know, contemporary examples that we're seeing right now, particularly in North Africa and the Middle East. Also, what's happening around environmental justice, and I'm sure there are many other examples that we could all discuss if we had a little more time, maybe as we move through the next few days. But I wanted to ask you all, if you feel like you're part of a social movement in the work that you're doing now, how many people feel that? I'm going to show here. Yeah? So a mix of people. To be honest with you, I haven't always felt that way. I think that I've often felt like I worked in a field. On my bad days, I felt like I was part of an industry. But I think I've been thinking more and more about this concept of movement and have been trying to talk and get more sort of fluent in the thinking and language around it, because I actually think that it's particularly important for us at this moment. These are some of the elements of building successful movements. And again, this is from the Movement Strategy Center and then also from a political scientist named Eva Thorne. So elements of movement building include having clear vision and goals, so everyone working together in a common direction, leadership that's aligned, focusing on those vision and goals. Movements have resources and infrastructure to support the work they're doing. And then also there are moments for movements, right? There's something going on in the political environment that makes movements possible. And then they have momentum and critical mass. And we, you know, we could like apply many examples to test these. Many people raise their hand as part of movements. I didn't ask what movement we felt like we were part of, because we all may feel like we're part of different movements or many movements. But I think that in our work to end gender violence and teen dating violence, we have actually a lot of infrastructure to do that work, and there are a lot of resources behind it. You know, we have local programs, we have state coalitions, we have national intermediaries that are working, we have government entities that are working on it. The economic and climate environment we're in, this is something that Grace Lee Boggs has talked a lot about, is actually a really important political opportunity for us, because how communities here in the U.S. in particular think about their role in the world globally is shifting. And so that might be another opportunity for us to start to reorganize ourselves. And then I think that in the past few months, I've had the opportunity to actually be on a Prevent Connect webinar where there were 300 people online talking about the power of community in creating change. I was on a TCTAT webinar listening in where over 50 participants talking about the power of local community change. And I think that, and all of the work that you in this room are doing, that we may be getting to see some momentum and maybe even building towards a critical mass on this sort of local community change piece. I think the question is, how do we really get in alignment around our vision and goals in the space that we're working in? Because I think that in many ways, and this is true in any kind of social change work, there are many things and innovations and ideas that are starting, whether it's the work around men, the work around young people, the work around providing crisis response, thinking about our different ways of addressing gender and teen dating violence, that we might all be going in a slightly different direction. And so I think one of the tasks before us is really to think about how is it that we get in alignment together Because how much more powerful is it if all of our energy is moving towards a common vision? How much more change are we really going to be able to create if that's possible? And then the vision that we would like to offer up to you, potential vision, is that of beloved community. Like, what does that really mean if we're all working towards that vision in our local communities, but on the same page so that we're creating that change in a broader-based way? So that's really what we wanted to leave you with, is something to think about. And in the meantime, as Grace Lee Boggs said before, that we have to be the change, we wanted to share one final poem with you that I think asks us all to consider how we do that. How do we all try to be the change in our lives, to build beloved community? This is called the ripple effect.
Do you want to be a positive influence in the world?
First, get your own life in order.
Ground yourself in a single principle so that your behavior is wholesome and effective.
If you do that, you will earn respect and be a powerful influence.
Your behavior influences others through a ripple effect.
A ripple effect works because everyone influences everyone else.
Powerful people are powerful influences.
If your life works, you influence your family.
If your family works, your family influences community.
If your community works, your community influences the nation.
And if your nation works, your nation influences the world.
Remember that your influence begins with you and ripples outward.
So be sure that your influence is both potent and wholesome.
How do I know that this works?
All growth spreads outward from a fertile and potent nucleus.
You are a nucleus.
Thank you for listening to this Prevent Connect podcast. Prevent Connect is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. To learn more about Prevent Connect, visit www.preventconnect.org. For more information about CalCASA's mission or to show your support, visit calcasa.org. That's CALCASA.org.